championship. With half the season and the playoffs still ahead, this should be everyone's total focus. That's my focus, period. The fight degenerated into an ugly exchange of low blows. Jackson let it be known that one of the issues involved Jordan's routine of going to the bathroom right before games. Krause always seemed to visit the restroom at the same time, which angered the star, who saw it as a violation of his privacy. Then it was leaked that Jackson had pulled a boneheaded move that year, buying underwear for a girlfriend that he mislabeled in shipping. The package was returned to his office, where an assistant, thinking it was for Jackson's wife, forwarded it to their house. The ensuing blow-up meant that Jackson spent the season living out of a Chicago hotel room. Jackson's players rallied around him in the crisis, which led Krause to suggest that the coach was using the situation to his advantage. "Phil is a player's coach very definitely," Tex Winter agreed. "It's very obvious that the players love him. Any time that you can get a superstar like Michael Jordan going to bat for the head coach the way he has, even to the extent to say that he's not going to play anymore unless he plays for Phil, you're not going to find that very often. That's a wonderful relationship. It's an indication of how Phil has cultivated that relationship." Jerry wants to be the most powerful person in the organization, and it's hard for him to allow Michael just to be Michael, Jackson said. Michael doesn't want power. He wants to be one of the players. But he wants a person who's not going to boss him around or shove him around or squeeze him into corners and do those types of things. That's what it's all about. As the playoffs neared, Jackson seemed to feel a twinge of guilt that his conflict with Krause would contribute to Jordan's career ending prematurely. "The only downside of this whole thing, in my mind's eye," the coach said, "is the fact that if Michael Jordan's not ready to retire, we're taking one of the greatest players or heroes that we've had in our society and limiting what he can do. We're deprived of seeing someone extremely special go out the way he wants to go out, in the style he wants to go out, because we've never seen someone of his age with the superstar status that he's had. I don't know of another sports hero in our history who has been able to play at this level at this age. Michael has just destroyed the concepts of what we think of as normal, of what a man his age should be able to do." "So that's the only downside in this whole thing," Jackson concluded. "Jerry Reinsdorf and I have a good relationship. Jerry Krause and I understand each other. We may not have as close a relationship as we used to, but we understand each other. I know he's got a direction he wants to follow, and he knows I've got some things on my agenda." Jordan's teammates marveled that he was able to continue performing at a championship level with the future of his career in doubt. "Michael is such a professional, such a player first, that he puts it in the background," Steve Kerr said. "Michael doesn't mess around. He plays." Yet Jordan's public relations skills rivaled his athletic abilities, and he used them to counter Krause's efforts to fire Jackson. "He's obviously a PR machine with all of his endorsements," Kerr said of Jordan. "His image is obviously very important to him, and I think, in one regard, that means that he doesn't want to look like the guy who's trying to take over the organization. He's very savvy." "There's more bullshit flying around this team than a dairy in a tornado," said Luke Longley. "There's always something going on. Dennis is always doing his thing, or something's going on. Michael's retiring, or Jerry's making noise. We've had more controversy or circumstance around this team in the last 3 years, so we've had a lot of practice at putting things out of our minds." When it came time to play the season's last game in Madison Square Garden in March, Jordan put on a pair of his early Air Jordans and didn't let the fact that they were too small stop him from scoring 42 on Jeff Van Gundy's team. Then he did it again for good measure, scoring 44 points on the Knicks in Chicago the last day of the season. Interviewed before that last game, Magic Johnson said of Jordan, "I thought I was the most competitive person I ever knew, until I met Michael." Jordan had taken Krause's pronouncement from Media Day and kept it right there in front of him. "Players don't win championships." Or as Tim Hallam, who had worked for him for years, described it, "That's a strong-willed motherfucker right there." Sixth Sense. Ultimately, the only hope the Bulls had to keep the team together was to win again. Anyone who saw Jordan play down the stretch that spring knew that he stood a good chance of forcing the agenda one more time. As things worked out, it would come down to Utah again. Although the Indiana Pacers, now coached by Larry Bird and led by Reggie Miller, almost derailed the reunion. In the Western Conference, the Utah Jazz had hummed along, just ahead of Chicago in the race for home court advantage if the teams made it to the championship series. Utah stumbled first with a key road loss in Minnesota, and Chicago claimed the best record in the league. The Bulls, however, also faltered. They lost in Cleveland, then defeated Orlando and became the first team in the league to win 60 games. But then the Pacers came to the United Center and challenged the Bulls physically, and won handily 114-105. In the aftermath, the Bulls lost again, this time on the road in Detroit, and finished the season at 62-20. That left them tied with Utah, except that the Jazz had won both games against Chicago during the regular season. Reggie Miller fired the Pacers as they pushed the Bulls through a grinding seven-game series in the Eastern Conference Finals that spring. Chicago prevailed only by virtue of home court advantage. After defeating Indiana on Sunday, May 31st, the Bulls practiced in Chicago on Monday, then jetted to Utah for a rematch with the Jazz for the league championship. Utah coach Jerry Sloan continued to operate by his dictum, "It's a simple game if you go out and lay your heart on the line every night." John Stockton and Karl Malone epitomized that ethos. The guard and power forward had long been a pick-and-roll machine. Stockton would become the league's all-time assist leader, and Malone would become just the third player to score better than 30,000 points. The Jazz always put up a nasty fight, battling every way possible, and there were always plenty of accusations that Stockton was a dirty player, but Jordan admired them both. To prove it, he longed to beat them again. But it was never about mental devices when he faced the Jazz. Just buckle your chin strap and see who's best. In Game 1, the two teams clawed their way to overtime. But in the extra period, Stockton victimized Kerr on a late shot in the lane to give the Jazz a 1-0 lead in the series. As was their trademark, Jackson and his staff made their adjustments for Game 2, which involved spreading their triangle offense and opening the floor up for easy baskets by their cutters. In the first half, the triangle had never worked better. "Tonight it really shined bright for us," Judd Bushler said. "It's an offense designed for anyone to touch the ball, to pass and cut. And the guys did that tonight, instead of going to Michael every time and posting up." Early on, everyone got involved, and that really helped out for later in the game. "The first half was beautiful," Winter agreed. "We followed through with our principles a lot better. Got a lot of cutting to the basket. And Michael gave up the ball. He was looking to feed cutters." But the old coach let his frustration show. "The second half, we abandoned it, aborted it," he said. "We tried to go way too much one-on-one. Michael especially forced a lot of things. If the Bulls had stuck with their scheme, they might have won by a dozen," the coach figured. But Jordan had delivered a win against Indiana in Game 7 by going to the basket and drawing fouls. He attempted to do the same in Game 2 against Utah, but the officials weren't giving him the calls. Instead, Jordan wound up on his back while the Jazz scooped up the ball and headed for easy transition baskets. Suddenly, a 7-point Chicago edge had turned into an 86-85 Utah lead with less than 2 minutes to go. "I don't know what it is," Winter said afterward, shaking his head. "Michael, he's got so damn much confidence." Jordan pushed the Bulls back ahead 88-86 with a layup with 49.7 seconds left. But moments later, with the game on the line and the score tied at 88, Kerr got open for a transition three. "I missed the shot and the ball went right to me," said Kerr. "Lucky bounce. As soon as I got the ball, I saw Michael underneath and just flipped it to him." Jordan finished, was fouled, and made the ensuing free throw to send the Bulls to a 93-88 win. The victory they needed to wrest away home court advantage. Back in Chicago after a practice, Winter admitted that where he once held out hope that the team might remain intact, he now saw that as the remotest of possibilities. "I don't think it's necessarily a shame to break it up," he said. "It's too bad that has to be, but you have to have changes. And it could be well timed." He didn't sound convinced, but it was Krause's main talking point. Winter had figured the Bulls would struggle to win the title in 97, yet here they were a year later in solid position again to rule the league. If the team returned, it would likely be too far past its prime to meet expectations in 1999, the coach reasoned. Jordan continued to surprise. But Rodman seemed to be wearing down and getting stranger. Pippen had back troubles, and some observers worried that he was checking out mentally. But Jackson had always been a man to renew his teams. Keeping the key parties together would take some therapy. But only Reinsdorf could heal the relationship between Jackson and Krause, Winter said. As it would turn out, the team chairman made an attempt late in the process, but by then it just wasn't possible. "Perhaps we could have enjoyed it more if we could have appreciated it," Jackson said. During the playoffs, the coach confided that despite the hard feelings, he and Krause would always be bonded by their mutual success with the Bulls. But Jackson said there was almost no chance of his return. He said he had tried to make it clear to Reinsdorf in 1997 that it was virtually impossible for him and Krause to keep working together. The implication was that the team chairman had faced a choice, the coach or the general manager, and had sided with Krause. But the coach was seldom one to close off options. "If it comes down to a chance of Michael playing and not playing, then my responsibility would be to him and to the continuation of his career and I would have to consider it, he said. I have to be a person that is loyal to the people who have been loyal to me. I feel that conviction. The only thing that would take me basically out of the mix would be my own personal well-being, my own personal physical and emotional health in dealing with this. Pippen, Harper, and Jordan made their best argument by overpowering Utah's guards in Game 3 in the largest rout in NBA history. The performance reiterated how absolutely dominant the Bulls could be as a team, and Pippen could be as an individual defender. The Chicago bench closed out the proceedings for a 96-54 victory. The margin was so great that a cross-country flight that had radioed in for a game update for a Utah fan had to call back a second time to confirm the score. Utah coach Jerry Sloan expressed surprise when he was handed a box score. "This is actually the score," the Utah coach said. "I thought it was 196. It sure seemed like they scored 196. With that one game, Jordan and his Bulls had made their case against Krause's plans to rebuild. They weren't too old, and Pippen was too special a player to toss away in a trade. "I almost feel sorry for them," Jackson said privately in discussing how Krause and Reinsdorf's agenda had been shattered and how they might come to be viewed by Chicago sports fans. It would be Rodman's free throw shooting, usually an adventure, that settled Game 4. He hit 4 in the closing seconds to go with his 14 rebounds to seal an 86-82 Chicago win and a seemingly insurmountable 3-1 lead in the series. As it turned out, Game 5 became a case of celebrating too early, as the Bulls basked in their impending victory. To be fair, it was also Stockton and Malone making a case of their own for an 83-81 Utah win. Even Jordan admitted getting caught up in the anticipation. "I really didn't have a tea time," he told reporters, "because I anticipated drinking so much champagne that I wouldn't be able to get up." He was 9 for 26 from the floor, and Pippen 2 for 16. It was Kukoc's 30 points on 11 of 13 shooting that gave them a chance to win it at the end, despite Malone's 39 points. The Bulls got the ball back with 1.1 seconds to go, and during the ensuing timeout, Jordan sat on the bench taking in the situation, inhabiting the moment as Jackson and George Mumford had taught him to do. A few moments later, Jordan missed a falling out of bounds shot, but that didn't prevent his treasuring the moment. "I'm pretty sure people were hoping I would make that shot, except people from Utah," he said. For 1.1 seconds, everyone was holding their breath, which was kind of cute. No one knew what was going to happen. Me, you, no one who was watching the game. And that was the cute part about it. And I love those moments. Great players thrive on that in some respects because they have an opportunity to decide happiness and sadness. That's what you live for. That's the fun part about it. With the series back in Utah, the Jazz had the same plan for Game 6 as for every contest. Lay it on the line. They charged out early and seized control. Pippen, meanwhile, pulled up with horrendous back spasms and wound up back in the locker room, where a massage therapist literally pounded on his back trying to drive the spasms out. One team employee reported Krause standing in a corner of the room, almost transfixed, watching Pippen absorb the blows, eager to get back in the game to help Jordan. "I just tried to gut it out," Pippen said. "I felt my presence on the floor would mean more than just sitting in the locker room. I knew I was going to come back in the second half, but I just didn't know how much I was going to be able to give." Pippen found a way to provide enough help to Jordan, who had fallen into another of his unstoppable trances. He would score 45, including the final jumper at the top of the key. After the final shot, he stood there for all to see, poised, arm draped in a follow-through perfect. Later, he wouldn't want to give up the moment. Who could blame him? His bucket gave Chicago the win, 87-86. "Things start to move very slowly, and you start to see the court very well," he said, explaining the last play. "You start reading what the defense is trying to do, and I saw that. I saw the moment." Stockton got one final shot, but Ron Harper hustled to help him miss. Jordan and his coach then met on the court for one long final embrace. They would never be so close again. Jordan slept deeply and peacefully on the plane ride home with everybody else wondering where things were headed next. Jackson's answer was to decline Reinsdorf's offer to stay with the team, choosing instead to ride off on his motorcycle. The players and coaches closed out their experience with a private, emotion-filled team dinner in the days after the championship game. They all expressed their love and regard for one another, and the tears flowed. Jackson later told the Sun-Times' Rick Thielander that he might have stayed on. "I did feel it was time to take some time off," he said. "What would have changed things is if management had said, 'Stay on until Michael is finished, until he retired.' But they never suggested that." During the spring of 1996, he and his attorney, Todd Musburger, had suggested a 5-year coaching proposal, but Reinsdorf turned them down, Jackson said. Next, the coach had suggested a 2-year agreement at about $3 million per season. Again, Reinsdorf declined. "We probably could have stayed intact one more year at least and made another run at a title," Jim Stack said in 2012. But the timing of the contracts, and then there were a lot of hurt feelings with the way Phil had sort of positioned the team against management. At the time, Phil was saying publicly that if Sylvester Stallone could make $10 million a film, he couldn't imagine how much would Michael be worth for 82 games a year. He really said some things that probably weren't the most appropriate things to say publicly. "I think Jerry Reinsdorf in particular had had enough," Stack said. "The way they were taking care of Phil financially, I guess that didn't sit that well with Jerry Reinsdorf. In all of those years that Jerry Krause had to deal with being outside the circle, Reinsdorf seemed to be betting that Krause could rebuild the team fast enough to keep the fans interested. He admitted that they almost broke up the team by trading Pippen in 1997. We considered giving up a shot at the 6th title to begin rebuilding, and we would have given it up if we could have made the right deal," Reinsdorf said. "The reason we considered breaking the team up is that we wanted to minimize the period of time between winning the last championship and getting back into contention with the next team. In other words, he hoped to minimize the time between the Jordan era and the next act on the United Center stage. We now have very little to trade, very little to work with in rebuilding," Reinsdorf said later and added, "Michael couldn't care less about what happens to the team after he leaves." "There's never been a power struggle," the team chairman said. "Phil never asked for Krause to be removed. It never happened. Phil never told me he thought we were a house divided. He said it was difficult to work with Jerry Krause, but not impossible. Phil never ever said that. He did express the fact that it was very strained. I asked him, 'Has anything changed? Do you want to coach another season?' He said, 'No.'" Reinsdorf said that he returned to Chicago and asked one more time. "Wednesday night after the title, we had our office celebration. I sat down with Phil and told him, 'If you've changed your mind, we want you back.' The offer was unconditional, and it stood regardless of whether Jordan returned," Reinsdorf said. Phil said, "That's very generous." I told him, "Generosity has nothing to do with it. You've earned it." He took a deep breath and said, "No, I have to step back." Reinsdorf also said that he had assured Jordan that if he wanted to play, his 1-year contract in excess of $36 million would still be there. Although Tex Winter had long worried that Jordan's fame was overshadowing the game, the star addressed that in the aftermath. "I think the game itself is a lot bigger than Michael Jordan. I have been given an opportunity by people before me. To name a few, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Dr. J, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West. These guys played the game way before Michael Jordan was born. Michael Jordan came on the heels of all that activity and, with Mr. Stern and what he has done for the league, gave me an opportunity to play the game of basketball. And I played it to the best of my ability. I tried to enhance the game itself. I tried to be the best basketball player I could be." In looking back, Steve Kerr recalled his favorite memory of Jordan and his final Bulls team. It involved a typical Phil Jackson assignment for his players as the 1998 regular season came to a close. "Phil had this great moment," Kerr explained. "It was the last day of the regular season, and he told us, 'Tomorrow at practice, I want everybody to write down a few words about this experience you've had with this team. It can be anything. You can write a poem. You can just write a letter to your teammates. You can take some lyrics from a song that are meaningful, whatever. But bring something tomorrow.' Half the guys brought stuff, and about half the guys forgot. I forgot. But Michael brought something, and it was a poem that he had written about the team. It was the ultimate triumph of Jackson's effort over the years. Jordan, the game's angry man and all-time badass, had written a poem. It was shocking," Kerr recalled. "What happened was, every guy ended up saying something, whether they read something or said something. Phil told me that June, his wife, had told him about this and suggested the idea. And so what he did was, after each guy spoke, whoever had written something down, he had to crumple up the paper and put it into a big coffee can. It was like a Folgers can. Then when everybody was done, he lit a match, and he lit the contents on fire in the coffee can. The lights were out, and there was this glow in the room. And it was like, all those memories that you guys just talked about, those are ours, and nobody else is gonna see. He didn't say that, but it was the metaphor. This is ours, and they're gone, and they'll forever live within us, and nobody else will ever see him." Phil Jackson burned Michael's poem. "I know, that thing would be worth millions right now, right?" Kerr said, laughing at the memory. "Michael's poem was, 'What does this mean to you? What does this experience mean to you? And where have you been and where are you going?' It was so cool. In a legacy of powerful moments that Phil, you know, left with us, that was by far the most powerful one. I'll never forget it. I was crying. A lot of guys were shedding tears. It had been such a long, hard, exhilarating ride being Jordan's teammate. Moments of supreme triumph interspersed with one sort of shell shock or another every single day. It wasn't just Michael, Kerr said. It was the experience. We all knew that we were living through this era that was so special, and we were so lucky to be a part of it. There were so many players and athletes and people who would have killed to have been a part of that. We were so lucky to have been a part of it, to go through this run, and it was ending. And we knew how special it was. And that was Phil's genius, was that that's how he bonded our team. He made us communicate, and he brought us together in so many different ways. And it wasn't going to happen without Phil, because Michael wasn't going to make it happen himself, because he was above the rest of us. He was better than the rest of us, and he wasn't a guy like Scotty who was human enough to have those emotions and frailties that you could relate to. So we couldn't relate to Michael, but Phil brought us together with the different things that he did. Jackson had brought Jordan full circle, the Michael Jordan who had been that insecure adolescent who went from being a star little leaguer to not even getting in the game the next season because he was too skinny for Babe Ruth ball. Michael Jordan, who sat the bench, the lone black kid, always among the white teams. Michael Jordan, whose father had given the impression of rejecting him. The driven Michael Jordan, who had proved to his father again and again and again, night after NBA night, how valuable he was in every way imaginable. That's what made him a badass, Kerr concluded, laughing, was that he wasn't just a talent. It was the understanding of it all, the work ethic, the game itself, the strategy involved. He got it all. He understood all of it. That, of course, only served to heighten the sorrow by season's end. The 6 championships notwithstanding. All that he had been through, his father's death, the humiliation of baseball, the infuriation of the trial, the alienation from his mother, his bitter negotiations with Reinsdorf, the silly battles with Krauss, his frustration with Pippen, it had all passed. And there he stood, resplendent in basketball perfection, with no place to go. Part 11. The Afterlife. Chapter 36. Limbo. In the minds of so many, Jordan should have simply inhabited that final perfect tableau against Utah for the rest of his known life, standing there with the clock drained down, his right arm and wrist hanging like a question mark in follow-through, the ball floating toward the goal, the sea of faces in the backdrop caught in suspense. Air Jordan, unconquered and unbowed till the end. There could be no better capstone, a career launched by one world-famous last-second shot, then, after 2 dreamlike decades, to close it all out with another peak moment. Other famous athletes were known for their big moments, but no one had ever had so many of them. No one had made them seem so routine. Then, to have his career all come down to that grand finale in Utah? Seemingly everyone's inclination, including Jerry Reinsdorf's, was to leave it alone. Don't do another thing, they told him time and again over the ensuing months. You've achieved perfection. How can you possibly improve on that? But that wasn't possible. Just a couple of days after the NBA Finals had ended so gloriously in Salt Lake City, never mind the grind of driving his Chicago Bulls to 3 straight titles, he was pressing to get on the links. Jordan had spent hours playing a video game version of what was then his all-time favorite course, the Fazio Designs at Barton Creek near Austin, with its stunning cliff-lined fairways, abundant waterfalls, and limestone caves. Now that another long NBA season was over, he planned to treat himself to the real course. And this is where Keith Lundquist came into the picture. Jordan was coming to Austin that Monday to play a couple of afternoon rounds at Barton Creek. A couple of days earlier, he had phoned to see if Lundquist, a Texas golf pro, could hook him up to play Great Hills that Monday as a tune-up. Great Hills was closed on Mondays, which would be a perfect time to accommodate Jordan and his party. So the club pro told Jordan he'd have things ready for him. He assumed that the star, now all of 35, would welcome a leisurely pace to unwind from the NBA grind. But that Monday, Lundquist's phone rang at an absurdly early hour. Jordan was on the line explaining that his private jet was landing and he was heading to the course. Lundquist blinked awake and looked again at the clock. Then he jumped out of bed and hustled to meet Jordan at the pro shop. Lundquist arrived at Great Hills to find an expectant MJ on the practice tee, furiously driving balls into the darkness. Lundqvist had been a pro for a while, but he had never seen anybody doing that. When they shook hands, the pro felt his paw disappear into Jordan's huge mitt. It was true, he realized. MJ was decidedly larger than life. As light broke across the sky, Jordan and his foursome, which included former NFL receiver Roy Green, were off. His airness was determined to get in as many holes as possible before appearing at a noon charity event. Lundqvist went along to usher Jordan over the course. I told him where to hit the ball, the yardages, and the tendencies of the greens, Lundqvist recalled of that day. He didn't play particularly well on the front nine. It was just a few days after the championship finals in the NBA. He was smoking cigars and enjoying himself. The foursome had a little action out there, but nothing heavy. He hit the ball exceedingly well, way beyond what I thought he could do. He can hit it, there's no question about that. By the time he reached Great Hill's challenging back nine, Jordan was clearly getting it together, Lundqvist said. He showed great touch around the greens. His hands were enormous, and he had enlarged grips for his clubs. His hand-eye coordination was really good. It's obvious that his athletic skill goes all the way across the board. By the back nine, club members had also discovered that Michael Jordan was on the closed course. An impromptu gallery of 60 or 70 quickly gathered. It was a development that greeted him nearly everywhere he played. Orlando attorney Mark Nijame once recalled gazing out of the window onto the golf course outside his home one morning to see a cart tearing down the fairway. A minute later, I saw at least 15 carts racing each other down the course, he recalled. It was MJ in the first cart and 15 members in hot pursuit trying to catch a glimpse of him. Jordan was personable and obviously accustomed to being followed around, Lundqvist said. He made a point during the round of coming over and chatting with me. He was using these Wilsons. I told him, you could find better clubs. Jordan agreed. They pay the bills, he said, referring to his endorsement deal with a manufacturer. Richard Esquinas once observed that Jordan played golf like he played basketball, always forcing the tempo and trying to find an advantage in it. That certainly seemed to be the case that day in Texas. Consuming hole after hole, the foursome clipped along at a strong pace, enough to tire anyone, thought Lundqvist, who then tagged along to the charity event in the noon sun, where an animated Jordan engaged easily with a throng of children and adults. That afternoon, Jordan knocked off another huge helping of golf holes on the handsome Fazio courses at Barton Creek. He finished just in time to ride to San Marcos for a charity basketball game in the evening. He played every minute of the game that night, Lundqvist said. He had to have been on the court at least 2 hours. I'd never seen anything like it. Afterward, Jordan repaired to one of Austin's fine restaurants, where he stayed well into the early morning, first carving up a steak, then smoking cigars and sipping expensive wine until it was time to run to the airport and jet away as dawn was again breaking in the Texas sky. Jordan departed, leaving Lundqvist to contemplate the otherworldly appetite that he had just encountered. Perhaps retirement would work well for Jordan. He had the bank account, the private jet, and the immense curiosity and energy to stalk the known world in search of the perfect golf round. It sure sounded ideal to observers such as Lundqvist, except for one thing. Could it possibly be enough? Jilted. Jordan would later admit to feeling jilted by Jackson's decision to leave the Bulls behind. A man of his word, Jordan had vowed to retire if Jackson wasn't his coach. It was hard to measure the impact of his split with Jackson, explained a close associate of both men. When you manipulate somebody, you get what you want. But when that person finds out he has been manipulated, that leads to alienation. That will affect the relationship, no matter how strong it once appeared. That's the consequence of manipulation. Jordan later gained clarity on Jackson in the wake of the final championship, on the firing of Johnny Bock and other things, but mostly it was the sense that Jackson had walked away from him. Jordan had managed to overturn Krause's edict that Jackson was through, yet the coach had left them all standing there, jilted. Krause then moved swiftly to deal Scottie Pippen to Houston. Pippen would collect his riches as a result of the trade, but the fracture with Jackson and the rupture of the team only drove his sense of alienation. Jordan, who trusted few people to begin with, now trusted even fewer. One close associate who had been a part of the tight circle that Jackson built with the team ran into Jordan later that year and immediately sensed that any warm feelings that had been created were now gone. We talked, the associate said, but it left part of me feeling that he didn't trust me anymore, not in the same way at least. It was like we were cool, but now we weren't cool anymore. If the trust that was the Bulls was gone, did that mean the experience was a mirage? With Pippen traded and Jackson gone, it became a foregone conclusion that Jordan would retire. But that move was delayed by a labor dispute between the NBA owners and players. It was an easy time for Jordan to lose himself as the NBA owners locked out the players over the 1998 offseason while they argued over a new collective bargaining agreement, one necessitated by his own huge contract. The owners simply didn't want to be paying Jordan-sized money to lesser players. The situation bought him more time to play around, ostensibly as he deliberated his future. During one of these lost weekends, he accidentally sliced a tendon in his hand with a cigar cutter, which required surgery and threw his future into further doubt. Meanwhile, his relationships with his mother and siblings were likewise in the various stages of suspension. Sis continued to struggle with her emotions concerning her father. Shortly after his death in 1993, she had begun writing her book, only to abandon the project in 1995. She remained a persistent critic of her rich and famous younger brother, especially over his gambling substantial sums, while she and other members of the family struggled financially. It wasn't that he didn't help them. For instance, he bought a tractor-trailer rig for his uncle, Gene Jordan, which allowed him to work as a trucker well into his 70s. Sis estimated that her brother had given her a total of about $100,000 over the years. She didn't expect him to take on her or her children as a responsibility, but she and others had become embittered by the revelations of the large sums he wagered. Her criticism apparently had a price. She noted that each of his family members received a brand new vehicle from their brother's Nissan dealership, except for her. She was given the keys to a used car. She pointed to that slight as evidence that he used his wealth to control them. By 1997, Sis and Michael had stopped speaking to each other. He had given everyone in his immediate family expensive jewelry pieces, commemorating each of his NBA championships. But in 1998, he did not give her the championship jewelry. In 1999, after his retirement, he reacted angrily upon learning that she was back working on her book. She said that he remarked that the book would be her attempt to sponge off his reputation by making exaggerated claims. Her reply was that she was simply not one of the numerous yes-men in his life, telling him what he wanted to hear, that she had known him and loved him long before he became famous, that unlike other relatives who offered the same criticisms in private, she was not afraid to speak out. Later that year, golfer Payne Stewart died in a plane crash, not long after winning the U.S. Open, leading Sis to think about how much time her brother spent zipping around the globe in his private jet. She phoned and left a message that she was concerned about him and wanted to know if he was okay. He sent a message through his mother that he was fine. He didn't speak to her personally, she later suggested, because Michael has a tendency to run from things he does not want to face, and his wealth affords him the opportunity to do that in many ways. While Jordan remained in touch with his mother, they were not nearly as close as they once were, friends and acquaintances noted. In the fall of 1996, they had made an emotional appearance together at the University of North Carolina to announce a $1 million gift to create a Jordan Institute for Families in the School of Social Work. If people wondered where Jordan got his legendary energy and drive, they needed to look no further than Dolores Jordan, who would continue to write and travel the globe to talk about family issues well into her 70s. A good portion of his charisma also came from his mother, Jim Stack observed. She's a wonderful lady, very cordial. He had components of all those things in his personality. The UNC Jordan Institute fit with her great positive energy and message, perhaps as a way for her to deal with issues that she had struggled with as a young mother. Later, word would circulate around Chapel Hill that the school was having difficulty collecting the gift. Was it his legendary stinginess, or was it a sign of the growing gulf between the star and a mother who had become one of his harshest critics? Or was it both? In time, the gift would be made, and the Institute would offer an array of programs for the School of Social Work, an important element in the Jordan family legacy. The summer of 1999 marked the sixth anniversary of James's death. Of the immediate family, Michael had been closest to his father, who had been his seemingly constant companion and advisor, his most ardent admirer. James had always been the one at his side, keeping things moving in a positive direction, offering constant encouragement in the face of the mountainous pressures Jordan encountered with the increasing complexity of his life. It seemed clear that for the remainder of his existence, Jordan would be caught between the two angels of his nature, his mother in one ear, encouraging a selfless public life lived at the foot of the cross, and his father in the other, telling him to take his fun where he could find it, because he had surely earned it. Mother and son had endured their battles in the wake of James's death, Sis reported, to the point that Michael had changed the locks on the foundation offices to deny her access there for a time. He had even attempted to limit her use of his name in her activities, according to his older sister. Yet Jordan continued to pay his mother a monthly stipend in addition to other financial support. And while they would get past their conflicts to some degree, the relationship appeared to have sustained some damage. His father was gone, but it seemed that in many ways the elder Jordan's influence loomed even larger than it had when he was alive. For some, the primary evidence of that was the lifestyle Jordan pursued away from the public eye. Others, however, saw that simply as a well-deserved release from his caged life in hotel rooms. Either way, Sis claimed to have seen it all coming. Like others in the family, she had supported the pretense that he was still the loving, caring, gentle younger brother she had known. With the birth of his bigger-than-life image, he has become imprisoned by his public status and hardened by the strain of success, she would write. Eventually, the pressures of being always on display and the pressure to live up to the public's expectations lessened his ability to relax, even with family. He had become a walking and talking conglomerate, she alleged. In all fairness, his defender said, that corporate existence was the essence of his long-term success. His emergence as a business figure was a large part of what distinguished him from the crowd of former athletes reduced to trying to wring a few dollars from their earlier glory. In 1999, Jordan was facing the challenge of trying to construct a second act. According to one study, as many as 90% of retired NBA players were broke within a few years of the end of their playing days. Many of them were ripped off by agents and money managers. Others were victims of an educational system that taught them little or nothing about managing wealth. Most of them fell victim to the life, a pricey style of living that proved impossible to sustain after their playing days were over. In contrast, Jordan's role as a partner with Nike and his other endorsements and investments brought him new millions each year. His wealth was routinely estimated at as much as $500 million, and he was often described as the first billion-dollar athlete. He had achieved long-term success despite the vagaries of a life in professional basketball, much as his grandfather Peoples had prospered despite the impossibilities of sharecropping. Better yet, Jordan's feats remained fresh in the memories of so many of his contemporaries. For years, interviewers had asked Jordan about his most memorable performances, and his reply had often been the standard, "I'll wait until my run is over before I evaluate what I accomplished." The response was understandable, though his public displays of emotion had long suggested that he reveled in those accomplishments. Passion was his signature. He had celebrated with memorable outbursts that riveted the attention of the global audience. As with the others who had helped create the cultural icon who became MJ, Sonny Vaccaro often marveled at the breadth of Jordan's reach and popularity. "Prior to Michael, no one had ever been marketed the way we marketed him," Vaccaro said, "and no one ever put as much emphasis on an individual athlete to sell a product." By 1999, Jordan stood alone at that pinnacle of a sports hero mythologizing culture. How deep was his global penetration? The Financial Review would express great surprise in December 1999 upon learning that as early as 1992, a survey of Chinese school children had named Jordan one of the two greatest figures of the 20th century, along with Zhou Enlai, the longtime Chinese premier. This was a good 5 years before the making of Space Jam, and well before Jordan's legend had gained its most serious momentum, with his first retirement, the public fervor of his comeback, and the winning of his final three championships in storybook fashion. "The nomination of Jordan seems bizarre," the Financial Review noted, "except that black sporting and athletic achievement provides some of the defining images of the 20th century." "How big is Michael Jordan?" Newsweek magazine had asked in 1993. "We all know he is a living god to tens of millions of American kids, the most mediagenic sports figure in history, a one-man conglomerate who can move goods and services the way a few words from a Federal Reserve chairman can move financial markets." His return in 1995 had driven his profile even higher. 4 years later, 800 reporters converged on Chicago's United Center to cover his second retirement news conference, fully aware that an era was ending. "Michael is one of the most important athletes, obviously. But even beyond that, he's one of the most important cultural figures in the history of the U.S., Todd Boyd, a University of Southern California professor specializing in sports and culture, said at the time. "I don't think that's in question. When you talk about an athlete who clearly dominated his sport, but also transcended the sport in terms of his success as a brand, his ability to market products, just what Michael Jordan came to stand for after a while, was perhaps the biggest transition anybody's been able to make from the basketball court to the highest realm of American popular culture." At the height of his popularity, The public often expressed surprise at any hint of irregular behavior by Jordan. But the greater surprise, as Sonny Vaccaro had suggested, was that there wasn't more of it to hint at. How could he not have been corrupted? Vaccaro asked. It would have been humanly impossible. How could you not? Remember, he had the Mars Blackman commercials he was doing in the early 90s with Spike Lee. They were immensely popular. Then he went on to do a film and commercials with Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes. He won all those championships and became the greatest athlete in the world. So indeed, Jordan's older sister was correct in assessing that the profound experience had changed him, Vaccaro added. It's been another Michael since we created the commercialism. He became another Michael. That took on a life of its own at such a young age. I don't know how you turn back from that. His admirers made the case that considering other victims of boundless success, such as Elvis or Michael Jackson, Jordan had done quite well in holding his ground against the many destructive options available to the lost and lonely inhabitants of such fame. This would remain true even in the many storms that lay ahead in his second act as a basketball executive and team owner, where before, his larger-than-life performance on the court always helped obscure his imperfections. His life as an executive offered no such cover. In fact, Jordan soon learned that it would only expose and amplify the negatives. Reinsdorf's loyalty. The NBA lockout finally ended in December, with a target of starting play in January 1999, which allowed Jordan to announce his retirement to an assembly of worldwide media gathered at the United Center on January 13th. Still, he declined to make his decision any more certain than 99.99% certain. Never say never, he said. Mentally, I'm exhausted. I don't feel I have a challenge. Physically, I feel great, Jordan said in explaining the move. This is a perfect time for me to walk away from the game. Some noted he didn't sound all that convincing. I think the league is going to carry on, although we've had our troubles over the last 6 months, he said, referring to the league's struggles over the new collective bargaining agreement that caused it to miss nearly half of the 1998-99 season. I think that is a reality check for all of us. It is a business, yet it is still fun. It is still a game, and the game will continue on. But it would have to do so without him. I'm just going to enjoy life and do things I've never done before, he explained. In short, he said, his newfound freedom would be consumed by his wife and three young children, his love for golf, and his many commercial endorsements. I see Michael doing a lot more carpooling, Juanita Jordan told the crowd of reporters when asked for her vision of Jordan's future. Unfortunately, Jordan continued, my mother, my family, brothers and sisters, could not be here. But as you see me, you see them. My father, my mother, and certainly my brothers and sisters. They are here through me, and they, along with myself, say thank you for taking me in and showing me the respect and gratitude you have shown me over the years I have been here. I will be in Chicago for the rest of my life. My wife won't allow me to move nowhere else. I will be in Chicago, and I will support Chicago teams. One reporter asked if Jordan might consider using his many talents to save the world. Jordan avowed that he was no savior. Indeed, he had failed to save the championship team that he had desperately sought to keep together. Yet Jordan made scant mention of the dispute at his retirement press conference, other than to point out that Bulls management had their work cut out for them. We set high standards around here, he said with a hint of a smile. I want to say thank you to the two gentlemen here, Mr. Stern and Mr. Reinsdorf, for presenting me with the opportunity to play the game of basketball and certainly giving me the opportunity to come to Chicago, meet my beautiful wife, and build a family here, he said. And my family in North Carolina, and a lot of my friends who have come up to support this day, support me, and who have always supported me once I stepped foot on the basketball court, and even when I didn't play on the basketball court. I want to say thanks to both of those gentlemen, and all the fans of Chicago for allowing me to come here, and they have adopted me as one of theirs. We are hopefully going to be known as a championship city, and I hope it continues on even when Michael Jordan is not in uniform. I will support the Chicago Bulls. He and Juanita had talked at his press conference of his slipping into a quiet existence and finally being a regular dad. He truly loved his children, had from the very start, so it seemed possible, until he actually tried to do it. The world's golf courses were waiting for him, his Jump 23 jet just sitting there, beckoning him to go anywhere he damn well pleased, to play cards all night en route, puffing cigars and joking with his pals. He continued to consume holes in what seemed like great gulps, virtual orgies of golfing and gambling, now tempered only slightly after his troubles in the early 90s. He would later be accused of pulling pal Tiger Woods into this strange and exclusive orbit, to the point that when Woods encountered his very public issues with sexual addiction, one of the golfer's representatives complained that running around with Jordan in his bacchanalian pursuits led to Woods' downfall. Even though Jordan had walked away from basketball, his competitiveness raged on, to the point that he truly craved action, always looking for the next buzz, playing rounds into the evening darkness with however much on the line he needed to make him feel that certain edge. Was it the adrenaline that addicted him, or was it the sense of escape from his life in the public eye where he was paid so well to be so perfect? Likely it was both and much more, including the fact that, given his inability to show himself in public, his golfing schedule kept him together with his friends. After 2 decades, he knew little else but a cycle of hanging out with the entourage, taking just enough meetings to sustain his business life, shooting commercials, all mixed with enough landings in Chicago to hold his family life together. Or so he thought. Whatever the root of it all, the days of his impromptu celebration in Austin in June 1998 had turned into weeks, then months, then a full-blown lifestyle. As Lacey Banks pointed out, Jordan had assumed the air of royalty, a status happily bestowed upon him by an adoring public. His insistence on the big expectations that came with such an existence hadn't gone away with his retirement. Through all the golf and unchecked fun, he soon decided that he wanted a place for himself in the game, to put into effect the values he had so clearly established as a player. He would teach the next generation important things about the game, he explained to reporters. His first thought was that he would assume an important position with the Bulls as a part owner with a role in management. To some, it seemed almost ludicrous that he would have such an expectation in the wake of the raging conflicts of his final seasons in Chicago. Jordan's anger alone was enough to make a tough guy like Jerry Reinsdorf blanch. Yet his Nike experience suggested a precedent. He had endured no small differences of opinion with Phil Knight over the years, but his presence and involvement with the shoe company had brought vast growth and wealth to Nike. Accordingly, he was rewarded richly with unprecedented power and influence over its direction. Clearly his efforts and energy had driven a similar growth for the Bulls, but if Jerry Reinsdorf ever considered a similar reward for Jordan, there is no record of it. It would have seemed logical to keep the immensely popular hero involved with the franchise, and it might have paved the way for Jordan to make yet another comeback in Chicago. Bringing Jordan into Bulls management would have meant altering or lessening Krause's role, if not his outright termination, considering the hard feelings between the two men. In 1999, those feelings were fresh in the minds of both Krause and Reinsdorf. They had had their faces rubbed in the circumstances again and again by the Chicago media over the 1997-98 season. Jordan was always right, and it seemed as if they were always wrong. We used to have a saying, Krause recalled in 2012. We said we could line up all the media at State and Madison Streets, and Michael could have pissed on each one of them, pissed right in their faces, and they would all say, "Oh, the nectar of the gods." That's how much he had the media in Chicago. He had complete control. The bitterness between the parties meant that letting Jordan join the Bulls as a minority owner was never a real consideration, regardless of how much money he had made for the stockholders. "Jerry never talked to me about it," Krause said in 2012 of Reinsdorf's response to Jordan's interest. It was never mentioned. Krause did recall the topic being raised by some in the media. "I kind of laughed it off because I know Michael," Krause said. "He's proven what kind of management skills he has." Krause also knew Reinsdorf quite well. "Jerry is a very stubborn human being," he explained, adding that loyalty was a huge factor for Reinsdorf. "The team chairman's loyalty was reserved foremost for Bulls stockholders," Krause explained. Although Jordan's efforts had made the stockholders quite wealthy, his role in management would be an entirely different matter, Krause said. "That could have been a bad fiduciary responsibility. I think Michael thought he would have it. Michael thought he was going to get everything. He didn't know what the job was. He had no idea." Krause also indicated that hard feelings over Jordan's final 2 contracts also remained a factor. "We had contract things with Michael that were not fun, that were bitter. Some of those feelings stemmed from the way Falk treated Reinsdorf in those negotiations," Krause said. Krause hastened to add that he and Reinsdorf respected Falk, in part because he was so tough in negotiations. Such respect did little to soften the hard feelings for Jordan. Jim Stack, who would later leave the Bulls to become an executive with the Minnesota Timberwolves, said that the question of Jordan remaining in Chicago was made more difficult by all of the years he had pushed for the team to acquire North Carolina players. "The other component of that is that Jerry Reinsdorf really trusted and believed in what we were doing as management," Stack said of the team's administration under Krause. Jerry Reinsdorf had had a taste of what Michael was pushing on us with the Walter Davis thing and some other things he wanted to do. I don't think Michael would have been satisfied with coming to the Bulls in some figurehead position. He would have wanted to be hands-on making the decisions. That would have been difficult. Even if Jerry Reinsdorf had wanted to bring Michael back, I don't think it would have been in a position that Michael would have been satisfied with or accepted. Stack, who had worked closely with both Jordan and Krause, shuddered at the thought of them in the same front office. There was no way those guys could have worked hand in hand, he said. Jordan shouldn't have been surprised by his rejection from Reinsdorf, observed reporter David Aldridge, who had long covered the NBA. I never got the sense that Reinsdorf ever thought of Michael as an executive. I mean, you can tell when somebody's being prepared to move into the front office. It doesn't take much to figure that out. I never had the feeling that they were prepping Michael for that role. Never. Perhaps a case could have been made that Jordan's continued association with the franchise would have been in the stockholders' best interests. He was, in fact, the league's one proven attraction, what Jerry West liked to call a license to print money. Jordan's value was not only in the tremendous growth in the team's revenue and value during the Jordan era, but also in the city of Chicago itself, especially the flourishing of the blighted neighborhoods around Chicago Stadium that had been transformed into a vibrant economic community, with the bars, restaurants, and other businesses that appeared with the opening of the United Center, the building that Michael built. Would Reinsdorf allow his anger to get in the way of doing what was in the best interests of the team's stockholders and the city? As for the idea that Reinsdorf owed Jordan anything in the wake of the team's overwhelming success, Krause said simply, "We paid Michael a lot of money to play basketball." Jordan's final contract, which paid him $33 million per year, confirmed that assertion, except that the career earnings rankings for NBA players released in 2012 offer a different view. On the list of the all-time NBA moneymakers, Jordan ranked 87th, just behind David Lee. Jordan's career earnings as an NBA player were a relatively modest $90 million. The list reveals that Jordan's success made it possible for the generation of stars that followed him, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant, and Shaquille O'Neal, to approach $300 million in earnings. Jordan had often pointed out that his success was built on the generation who came before him, who earned a relative pittance. He said it stood to reason that he would earn less than those who followed. Yet Jordan also ranked far behind even his contemporaries. Patrick Ewing led the group of players from Jordan's era with $119 million in earnings. Scottie Pippen raked in $109 million, much of which he earned after leaving the Bulls. Hakeem Olajuwon earned $107 million, with Gary Payton, Reggie Miller, and Karl Malone all earning more than $100 million. The record reflects that the Bulls extended no great largesse to Jordan in recognition of the wealth he brought the team shareholders. Lakers owner Jerry Buss, for example, paid $14 million to Magic Johnson upon his retirement, in part to express gratitude for leading the team to five NBA championships and helping to greatly increase the franchise's worth. Buss and Johnson, however, had what has been described as something akin to a father-son relationship, whereas the once strong Reinsdorf-Jordan relationship had suffered tremendously with a feud over Pippen and Jackson, to the point that Reinsdorf promptly spurned Jordan once he retired from playing. Jordan's income shortfall can also be explained by his attitude. He claimed always to be playing for the love of the game. Even later, when he returned to playing, he would do so for a minimal amount. He took great pride in earning his substantial wealth, more than $1 billion by some estimates, off the court. Jerry Reinsdorf almost certainly denied his partners yet more riches by declining to hire Jordan. Yet the team chairman was like most everyone else. He had had enough of the conflict and allowed Jordan to ride off into the sunset. In the end, Michael felt like there was still more gas left in the tank, Jim Stack said, but it ended with him having to walk away without a choice, which was really hard for him. Krause did request one final meeting with Jordan late in his career. The occasion had led Krause to think of his first meeting with Jordan 14 years earlier, in the spring of 1985. After that came the foot injury, and from there the two men watched their differences multiply. The animosity and all that really started to come into play then, Sonny Vaccaro recalled, and it carried on until it really got to be an ugly thing. My job was not to be Michael's ass-kisser, Krause offered. Krause still felt the need for some sort of reconciliation or closure, and hoped perhaps a meeting might help clear the air, so he asked him to come to his office at the Berto Center. He began by confessing that all of the years he had needled Jordan by telling him that Earl the Pearl Monroe was better, he was not being truthful. You were better than him early in your career, Krause said, but I couldn't tell you that. I knew it, Jordan replied, as if he had at last been supplied with a gotcha moment. He was like, okay, Cross recalled at the moment. It was very brief. Michael and I are never going to break bread. He remembers everyone who ever didn't think he was going to be great. He remembers every negative story that's ever been written about him. He would certainly remember Jerry Krause, even after he had landed elsewhere. Chapter 37. The Wizard. At first, Jordan seemed headed to Milwaukee to become part owner of the Bucks, but Bucks owner Herb Cole backed out of the deal at the last moment. As it turned out, Jordan's new domain would be Washington, D.C., where he connected with Ted Leonsis, the America Online magnate who had become a part owner of the Washington Wizards, once the infamous Washington Bullets. Jordan had looked in Charlotte at the Hornets, but owner George Shin was in the process of infuriating fans in the basketball-crazy state who deserted the franchise in droves. The Hornets would pack up and flee to New Orleans, leaving behind a city feeling thoroughly betrayed by the NBA experience. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Jay Mariotti maintained that Phil Jackson, who coached the Lakers to the NBA title in 2000, wanted Jordan to join that team. The money was supposedly minimal, but it would have been an opportunity to be a part of a Lakers team that was poised to win more titles. Jordan supposedly declined, ostensibly because Washington was offering a piece of the team with the understanding that in time Jordan would become the majority owner. Washington, as opposed to Los Angeles, was a city that had to be reminded that there even was an NBA experience. The Wizards' Bullets had established a well-crusted mediocrity that stretched back over two decades. The fact that Jordan connected with Abe Pollins' team, with such a struggling franchise, came as a surprise to many. During the NBA lockout just months earlier, Jordan and the Washington owner had engaged in a bitter exchange witnessed by several players, among them Reggie Miller, who would later credit Jordan with helping the players turn the tide in the negotiations to get a better deal with the league's owners. In 98-99, we were having a meeting in New York, and all the players were supposed to be there, Miller recalled. Michael Jordan supposedly had just retired. When we all got there, there was Michael Jordan getting ready to face off with some of the owners and the commissioner, and he almost got into a shouting argument with the late, great Abe Pollin. Michael Jordan was going at Commissioner Stern and Pollin, talking about if you keep writing these bad checks to these bad players, maybe you need to give up ownership of your team. Pollin had complained about the difficulties of running a team. Then sell your team, Jordan brashly told Pollin. Neither you, Michael, nor anyone else is going to tell me when to sell my team, Pollin shot back. It seemed unlikely that the two would be able to work together. Jordan, however, was too valuable a connection for a team like Washington to turn down. It was easy to imagine his airness bringing some luster back to the idea of professional basketball in the nation's capital. The buzz was incredible, David Aldridge said of the announcement that Jordan would join the Wizards as a minority owner and basketball executive. I remember like it was yesterday. The headline was above the fold in the Washington Post. This was the newspaper that took down Richard Nixon. The headline above the fold was, Jordan coming to Washington. So it was big, huge. By the fall of 1999, when Leonsis began making the move to pull Jordan into ownership management with the Wizards, the hard feelings had seemingly melted. Pollin was ebullient in his public statements about the game's greatest player joining his team. The negotiated partnership between Pollin and Jordan was a merging of the old NBA with the new. Pollin, who owned a construction company, was in his early 40s when he bought the old Baltimore Bullets in 1964. One of Pollin's earliest employees was a portly young scout named Jerry Krause. They would remain friends and confidants for decades. Pollin would also grow close with a young lawyer working for the NBA named David Stern, who in 1984 would become the league's commissioner. Pollin was mostly connected to the old line NBA, especially Detroit Pistons owner Bill Davidson, Aldridge recalled. I think he had a great affinity for the older owners in the league, who maybe had an appreciation for what it was like to meet a payroll back when you weren't sure how you were going to do it. And he certainly felt like a mentor for Stern. I know he had a good relationship with Jerry Krause, and I know they talked a lot about a lot of different things. That high regard for Krause, however, wasn't necessarily shared by the people who worked for Pollin, Aldridge recalled with a laugh during a 2012 interview. There's a lot of people in the Bullets organization who think Jerry may have overstated his role in drafting Earl Monroe, that sort of thing. When you would ask people about Jerry and the Bullets organization, there would be some eye-rolling and, oh yeah, that's the guy that discovered Earl Monroe. Krause, however, remained a big part of Pollin's talk network of owners and GMs around the league. Pullen and Kraus were known to share opinions and a view of their respective teams in their discussions. It later became clear that the Washington owner had a certain view of Jordan long before he joined the Wizards franchise. It appeared that the good news for both Pullen and Jordan was that they shared a similar trait. They were extremely loyal to old friends. Considering that in 2000 Pullen was entering his fifth decade owning the team, he had a lot of such friends, many of whom were on his Wizards payroll. Although his franchise had become one of the league's sorriest operations, the first decade of Pullen's ownership in Baltimore had culminated in Monroe's leading the team to the 1971 NBA Championship Series, where they were promptly swept by the Knicks. Even with that success, ticket sales remained dismal in Baltimore, which pushed Pullen to follow through on his original plan to move the team to Washington. In 1973, he built the Capital Center in the Maryland suburbs as the home for the Bullets and the pro hockey team he founded, the Capitals. The 70s would be the high watermark for the Bullets. With Casey Jones as coach, they dominated the 1975 regular season, only to be swept in the league championship series by the Golden State Warriors, a huge upset. Pullen soon turned to old Kraus nemesis Dick Motta as coach, and the Bullets returned to the championship series in 1978 with young center Wes Unseld and star Elvin Hayes. There, they won the franchise's only championship, beating the Seattle Supersonics in 7 games. For 1979, the two teams again returned to the NBA Finals, where Seattle claimed the championship, but the glory years would end there. The owner had lost both an infant son and a teenage daughter to heart disease. That perhaps helps explain the close relationships he formed with Unseld, his center from the glory years, who would remain a Bullets fixture as a coach and executive, and Susan O'Malley, the daughter of a business partner and political ally, who became a longtime team executive in charge of marketing and public relations. Among Pullen's values, Aldridge observed, was the answer to the question, how do you treat the people you work with? Pullen treated his people extremely well, although his loyalty over time had worked to the detriment of the organization, Aldridge said. I started covering the Bullets in 1988. And by 2008, if you went to a game, I'd say maybe 60-70% of the employees were still there. You go, what's going on here? You certainly aren't rewarding these people for success because the Bullets were a bad franchise. Maybe the Clippers were worse, but that's not saying much. Another owner might have at least decided to change leadership to shake up the culture of the team, not Pullen, Aldridge said. You looked at it and asked, why are you keeping all of these people? Abe, he was an incredibly loyal guy. He wouldn't fire Wes Unseld, even though Wes's record, if you looked at it, was not sterling. I mean, you're talking about 7 or 8 years as the coach and then GM. In the best season that Aldridge covered the team, they finished 40-42, he recalled with a laugh. That was the zenith of my years covering the Bullets. It was horrible. They were as bad as you could be for a long time. Were there a lot of reasons for that? Sure. And many of those reasons were not anybody's fault, but the bottom line is the bottom line. The NBA is a results-oriented business, right? You knew that Abe was incredibly loyal. He was incredibly loyal to Susan O'Malley for a long time. He was incredibly loyal to Wes for a long time. Even the PR people never changed until they left of their own volition. I don't remember him firing anybody. Abe was loyal, and he expected loyalty in return. But I think, more important than that, he expected a certain amount of respect. Pullen had done much to earn respect in the Washington community. He gave substantial sums for relief for the city's indigent population. His building of the MCI Center in downtown Washington in 1997 brought a dramatic and sorely needed surge of financing to revive the nation's capital. Yet with basketball, he and his teams had largely been chumps. At least that was how they were seen around the NBA at the turn of the century. The owner believed that Jordan's involvement would help alter that image. There was no question that at 37, Jordan was an elder statesman of the game, but by the time he began his romance with the Wizards in 2000, he still lacked management experience. He had been a high-energy basketball player whose sole method of assessing player potential was through personal confrontation on the court. While he had unprecedented experience playing the game and leading his teams, he had never assembled any sort of roster or even done coaching at any level. Even so, Abe Pullen was desperate to upgrade his team and generate some buzz, which put Jordan in a strong negotiating position. Pullen agreed to certain concessions, but it was Jordan's pushing for those concessions that apparently created the first hardening of feelings in the relationship even before it got off the ground. First was the issue of time. Jordan wanted only a part-time involvement, to allow room for his other business interests, including his obligations to shoot TV commercials. The schedule also cleared plenty of free time for his golfing and other interests. Contractually, he wanted an obligation of attending no more than about a half dozen games each season. He also wanted no heavy role in publicizing or marketing Wizards games. That proved difficult for the long-suffering team staff to swallow, especially given Jordan's magnetism. "It was a worldwide story," David Aldrich explained. "I'm just talking about the impact of Jordan coming to Washington in any capacity, as an executive or as a player. It was just enormous. He would get standing ovations just when they would show a picture of him sitting in the owner's box. There would be standing ovations. And it was like, wow. And he was like cringing. He didn't want to do that. So he would go hide in his office where they couldn't see him." These conditions immediately chafed at the team's long-term staff, particularly Pullins' favorites. To aid in his executive duties, Jordan brought in old trusted friends, Rod Higgins, who had experience as a coach and executive with Golden State, and Fred Whitfield, who had worked for both Nike and David Falk. He also hired Curtis Polk, who had worked for years with Falk. The Wizards were loaded with bloated contracts for aging players, and Jordan's people set about the work of ridding the franchise of those destructive deals. It was a textbook approach to rebuilding a franchise, but any real accomplishments would soon be lost in the acrimony that was to follow. Jordan also brought in his old friend Johnny Bock, now in his late 70s, to assist the coach he had yet to hire. He tried to lure John Paxson to Washington from Reinsdorf's staff in Chicago, but Paxson declined. He also tried to hire Mike Jarvis to coach. Jarvis wanted too much money, Aldrich explained. Leonard Hamilton finally agreed to become his coach, and the die was cast. There were smiles aplenty at the beginning, but Jordan and Polin were clearly eyeing each other. Jordan observers wondered how his demanding nature and the attendant anger would play in the nation's capital. As it turned out, there was conflict aplenty. Jordan had spent years under the guidance of Phil Jackson, who had a knack for creating tension within an organization by nurturing an us-versus-them mentality between the team and management. Jackson had used that to great effect with the Bulls until it became toxic, and he would do the same with the Lakers. The hard feelings in Chicago existed between Jackson and a substantial amount of the team staff. During the 1994 playoffs in New York, Jackson won praise for lightening his team's mood by having them skip practice one day and load on a bus for a visit to the Staten Island Ferry. What wasn't known was that a block from the team's hotel, Jackson told the bus driver to stop and ordered the only woman on the bus, a veteran publicity assistant, to get off. The woman was humiliated by the move and soon left the team's employment. It was one of several moves that led some staff members to resent Jackson. "Phil was very good at that," Krauss offered. "He wasn't the only coach to create that us-versus-them atmosphere between the team and the staff. A lot of NBA coaches do that to some degree, but Phil was good at it." Perhaps Jordan didn't intentionally set out to create such an atmosphere in Washington as the manager of basketball operations, but that was what he had known in Chicago. Soon enough, Polin and his staff felt the divide and took umbrage. "He wrote the checks," David Aldrich said of the Washington owner. "You've got to have a certain amount of deference. People may think he's past his prime and he doesn't know what he's talking about, all those things, but he still owns the team. I tell you what happened. There was an atmosphere where, when Michael came in and he brought all of his people in, he brought Higgins and he brought Fred in and Curtis Polk and all these people, there was this sense of, okay, step aside. The real movers and shakers are taking over now. You just stay over there and be quiet and we'll throw you a bone every once in a while." "I remember," Aldrich said, "that it didn't take very long before you started hearing things from people in the organization. You know, hey, Abe wants to have lunch with Michael. He hadn't had lunch with him in 2 months or 4 weeks or whatever it was. And so you would hear these things and you would go, wow, this is something he needs to keep an eye on. I think Michael's people pushed the other people to the side." Susan O'Malley had gone to work for the Bullets and moved up through the ranks to become a team vice president. She had always been aggressive in terms of marketing the Bullets and then the Wizards. But because the team wasn't good, she and the staff had settled into a pattern of marketing tickets not on the notion of seeing the Wizards play, but by promoting the marquee players and teams that would come into town. "That is what they did," Aldrich said of the Wizards' marketing staff. "They marketed the other team. Come see the other team play because our team is not very good." When Michael resisted that, it caused some angst. Jordan took the old hardline approach, similar to that of longtime Boston Celtics boss Red Auerbach, who believed that the strength of the team and how well it played should sell the tickets. "Susan wanted to utilize Michael in ways that he did not like," Aldridge observed. He said, I don't want to be a show pony. I don't want to come out and shake people's hands. And that was a problem. After so many years in the spotlight, Jordan had also arranged to have tougher public relations practices that restricted journalists' access to him. That in turn meant there would be no sense of intimacy with the media in Washington, similar to this way he once held with the media in Chicago. He wanted to do less, not more, publicity and promotional work in his new capacity. His routine denials of O'Malley's requests for his time began to erode the relationship as well. All it took was a few TV shots of Jordan exiting an arena parking lot in his car with Illinois license plates to emphasize a dramatic shift in the Jordan approach. Known as a relentless worker during his playing days, Jordan was now an absentee figure. Aldridge and his fellow sports journalists tried to figure it out. You know, Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon and I would have these debates all the time. Kornheiser said, he's got to be out front. He's got to be a man of the people and hang out. I tended to agree with Wilbon, who used to say, they've got TV sets in Chicago. It doesn't matter where he is as long as he's doing his work. In sports, it only matters if you lose, and Leonard Hamilton's teams not only lost, they descended into open conflict, right on the bench. Hamilton would prove many times over that he was an excellent college coach, but even Johnny Bock couldn't protect him from clashing with pro players. The nadir came in the middle of a game one night when Hamilton called for arena security to remove one of his players, Tyrone Nesby, from the bench after they got into a heated disagreement. Michael had his opinions on what he wanted to put together, Johnny Bock recalled. He never got really going because he had a college coach who had never coached in the pros. Things didn't work out well. Looking for a way to get the thing headed in the right direction, it occurred to Jordan one day that spring that the best way to help the organization might be to play, to come back and teach these young players about respecting the game and playing hard. That was how he had lifted the Bulls up from their misery, by playing. Yes, he was younger then, but he reasoned that now he knew so much more. Yes, he had gotten fat as an executive and his knees were in terrible shape, but he could begin working out with old friend Tim Grover, who now had an exclusive training facility in Chicago, where Jordan himself was an investor. Grover would get him back in shape. Johnny Bock thought it was a terrible idea and immediately began trying to talk him out of it. For the good of the franchise, he was trying to please Abe and play, Bock recalled. He knew we wouldn't win in a big way. That was the thing that stunned David Aldridge. Jordan, who had always cared about winning, was going to put his reputation on the line, knowing full well that the team couldn't win, not in the way that the public would expect. But he was willing to do that anyway to get the franchise turned around. It was like baseball all over again. He was headed into something that was doomed from the start. I wanted him not to play, Bock said. I told him he had nothing to prove anymore in life. I saw the struggle he had with it, to try to play the type of game he'd always had. It didn't come as easily. Fatigue would set in practice. He had to work on the bicycle to get the tone he wanted in his legs. He struggled to make sure he could play. I thought he was taking on more than he could do. I've watched guys come back to the game. I've watched fighters come back to the game. I had seen DiMaggio struggling in center field. I had seen Joe Louis hammered out of the ring. There are very few people like Rocky Marciano. He won them all, and he walked away. That's what you have to do. I was hoping Michael would do the same thing. What more could he win? My whole hope was that he would perform well there in Washington, and he did. He averaged 22 points a game, and he filled the arena. Pullen was delighted at the news that Jordan was considering a return. He would bring tens of millions in revenue to the team, and, better yet, Jordan would have to sign away his minority ownership in the team, since NBA rules did not allow a player to hold ownership shares while competing. The original plan in Jordan's mind was that when he was done playing, he would take the minority shares back and complete a deal to buy majority ownership of the team. Jordan did not call Falcon to negotiate the deal. There could be no deal, no assurances. He would have to trust Abe Pullen to hold his shares, then return them to him when he was done as a player. Jordan, who was slow to trust after his experience in Chicago, agreed to trust Abe Pullen. He was the guy who never fired anyone, who kept all of his old associates around. The Wizards completed another dismal season that year and later won the number one overall pick in the NBA draft lottery. Jerry Krause remembered flying home from the lottery with Fred Whitfield and Rod Higgins on the same plane, some rows behind him. He was pretty sure they were laughing at him behind his back. I remember thinking, they'll fuck it up, Krause recalled. The league had not yet instituted rules that allowed players to be drafted only after they had played at least 1 year of college, so the field that year was filled with big teenagers. The Wizards took a 6'11 high school senior out of Georgia named Kwame Brown. who had been named the MVP of the McDonald's All-American game. The Bulls had two